The final accounting of what can happen to a whole country when banks go wild. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. The final exhaustive report on the great financial collapse in Ireland is out today. A parliamentary committee has drawn up three volumes detailing just how what was called the Celtic Tiger became bankrupt overnight and the Irish stock market fell 80% in 5 months. Reporter Dermot Fleming joined us from Dublin. Dermot, good morning to you.
Good morning, David.
So refresh our memories, if you could. Ireland was not Greece. The budget going into the great financial crisis, there was not secretly awash in red ink. What caused the government to essentially go bankrupt back then was a fateful decision, I think, to guarantee the Irish banks, to backstop them.
In 2007, 2008, the economy was booming. Most of it was related to property development. There was a reckless lending spree as a result. Now, that all came crashing down due to external world economic factors in 2008. There were big concerns over one particular bank in Ireland, Anglo-Irish Bank. And as a result, suddenly in September 2008, the government decided to guarantee a number of the major banks here. Now, that proved to be a very fateful decision because what it actually did was transfer the huge debts that these banks had accumulated onto the shoulders of the Irish people, and that's a cost that people are still paying today.
But just why the mechanism that caused Anglo-Irish and the other banks to run into such trouble, we'll learn more from this final report today about that.
The report is very critical of how the central bank here and the financial regulator regulated the banks. And the report is also very critical of the European Central Bank, which it says refused to allow the Irish government to consider any burden sharing with major bondholders in these banks. In other words, that the debts of the banks would be shared by some of the investors in those banks. So these investors would have profited when the good times were rolling, but they weren't made come up with any money when things went bad. Those debts were placed on the shoulders of the Irish people. The reason for that was that the European Central Bank had a policy to refuse to allow any bank in the Eurozone to fail, because if you had this potential weak link, it could affect the integrity of the entire Eurozone. So the report shows that the Irish government at the time came under severe pressure from the European Central Bank, which said that it would withdraw funding. The most interesting thing really from the report is likely to be this severe criticism of the European Central Bank.
From Dublin, reporter Dermot Fleming frequently contributes to the BBC and others. Dermot, thank you for this.
Thank you.
Irish people are still feeling the effects of the austere government budgets imposed after the collapse. The economy is still smaller than it was before the crisis. And the unemployment rate in Ireland is at 8.8% compared to 5.1% in Britain, for instance. Starting today, telecommunications and software companies in the U.S. can begin offering customers in Cuba credit, something that has not been legal in decades as sanctions gradually ease. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
For U.S. companies, trading with Cuba is increasingly like trading with anybody else.
This is yet another step that just makes it more normal.
Gus Maxwell is an attorney at the law firm Ackerman in Miami.
All these kinds of things are slowly but surely, you know, undoing 50-plus years of a restrictive policy.
U.S. exports to Cuba last year reached $175 million by the end of November. Analysts predict with the greater availability of credit to Cuban customers, that figure could shoot up. Lawyer Janet Kim with Baker McKenzie says telecom, the financial sector, and healthcare will likely profit.
For the other industries, it's a bit tougher right now because you'd have to go in for specific advance approval from the U.S. government.
Kim says the Obama administration can only relax so many restrictions on its own. To really return to normal relations, including travel, Congress and the executive branch must work together. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
story of how so many people in Flint, Michigan were poisoned by lead in their drinking water is, among other things, about the politics of regulation and possibly double standards when it comes to the treatment of poor communities. It's also a story about failing infrastructure. High levels of lead began to flow into the water system when they were disturbed by corrosive water from the Flint River, which the city opted to use as a water source in 2014 to save money. Fixing the problem in a sustained way could involve an expensive public works project, since the pipes that lead to the houses, what are called service lines, are sometimes made of lead. From Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk, Lizzie O'Leary reports.
Here's the question at the root of the issue.
Hi.
Do you know if you have a lead service line?
Some guy came by the other day and asked me something about that, a lead service line.
I don't think anybody knows. I don't think I do. Our water's been clear. It's been fine. Doesn't smell. Doesn't taste bad. We don't take any chances, but.
And you don't think anybody knows?
I don't. Somebody's got to know. Somebody downtown, probably.
Well, the thing is, the city doesn't really know. Flint is an old city and, frankly, pretty close to broke. Its water records live on faded and peeling maps and thousands of index cards in this big gray filing cabinet in the city's water service center.
Looking at this, you've got card after card after...
50,000.
50,000?
Yes, there are 50,000 cards in this catalog, but nobody knows the exact number.
And if anybody does, it's him. That's Alan Roberts. He works at the Water Service Center, and he's slowly been building a database of Flint service lines by looking at the cards to see what the pipes are made of.
That little C says copper.
Wow.
So, and there's approximately 50,000 of these. Now, let me show you this map directly behind you. It is that square, grid square of the city.
Okay. So you basically have to go map by map, house by house, and look at every line.
It's incredibly tedious, yes.
Roberts was doing this on his own long before Flint's water crisis became a national concern. Now, a team from the University of Michigan at Flint is putting this data into their computerized mapping systems. They hope to finish compiling their information in about 10 days. Then they'll share it with the city and the state. So far, about 10% of the homes they've mapped have lead service lines. But because Flint's records are so spotty, the final percentage could be higher. And Flint isn't an outlier. Many old cities don't know where their lead lines are, according to Lyke Thompson, a professor at Wayne State University. But unlike Flint, other cities put anti-corrosion chemicals into their water to make sure the pipes don't leach.
Since the corrosion control works, they don't have to know exactly where those lines are.
Flint doesn't have that option. Replacing the lines could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but they have to find them first. In Flint, I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
This week, some big companies, Walmart, Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle, said they are donating more than 6 million bottles of water to students in Flint. That is enough for 10,000 school children per year, at least during their hours while they're at school. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.